session number 11307, reel 3.
Yes, you were saying about your attitude towards the sinking of the Belgrano, and I was saying, were you aware of the controversy in Britain about it at the time, whether or not it should have been shot, attacked?
Yes, I don't believe we were aware of the controversy, but if we had have been, it would have been probably met with typical naval cynicism, in that it's the people on the ground who should be fighting the battle rather than the politicians, and although they have very close control, if something is seen as a threat, then it should be taken out. One of the greatest dangers is a sort of half-hearted approach to operations, in that the politicians forever keep trying to rein you back. If you're given a job, you should be allowed to get on and do it. Now, perhaps one draws the line at bombarding Buenos Aires, but in taking out a threat which is in the vicinity of your area of operations, if you consider it a threat, then you should be allowed to remove it. And I think it was removed reasonably well with minimal loss of life, and certainly no loss of life to any British serviceman, which was the important part of it.
So could I ask you now, because I think we're approaching the time, aren't we, soon after the sinking of Belgrano, when Coventry was engaged in action, I believe you mentioned this earlier, didn't you, using your, was it the Sea Skua,
that was a little bit later. We had a couple of fast patrol boats, or patrol boats, who were seen some distance from us, and it was too far from our group for surface ships to be detached, and the most cost-effective way of dealing with them was by the Lynx helicopter armed with Sea Skua. I can't remember the date, but it was a nighttime attack on one patrol boat, and it was completely destroyed by the Lynx crew.
Did you see anything of that yourself?
Only the launching and recovering of the aircraft, and that was it. Sea Skua is a relatively short-range weapon, sort of 6 to 8 miles or thereabouts, and the Lynx didn't come under any threat herself, as far as I know.
And was that good for morale, the fact that was successfully...
Well, that was excellent, yes. We had only a handful of missiles anyway, and we had used them very effectively and taken out what we perceived to be a threat almost surgically. The Lynx was launched, it was put onto the right target, everything went relatively smoothly, and then the Lynx returned and that was the threat gone. So it was a great boost to morale. But I think in keeping with this confidence idea, it was nothing less than we expected. We would have been very surprised, aghast, if it hadn't worked.
When was the Sheffield hit? This had been around this time that the Sheffield was hit and lost.
Sheffield, I believe, was hit on the 3rd or the 4th of May. We had wind of an air attack, although we hadn't, I don't believe we'd engaged anything but by this stage in our group. The three Type 42 destroyers were up threat at about 20 miles from the main body, which gave main force coverage because the threat was actually quite a wide axis. And Coventry was to the northwest, Glasgow was to the west, and Sheffield was to the southwest. The first we knew about it was on the air defence radio circuit that she'd been hit, and then she must have been about 30 miles away from us. We could see a big pall of black smoke for some time. It was actually a very calm, sunny day, despite the normal reports that the South Atlantic is always windy and blowing the gales. It was actually quite pleasant weather. We had little or no action, or little or no involvement in that action, because it all came from a different threat. There's no way that we could give any coverage to something 30 miles away, heading off at a tangent.
But this would have been your sister ship, wouldn't it? The Sheffield, similar type to yours.
Very much, yes.
Yes. What was the effect of that? The fact that she was... How many missiles did it take to knock her out?
I can't remember whether she was hit by one or two. I think she might have been hit by two. But of course, it wasn't the missile itself that was the problem, it was the subsequent fire, mainly through unspent fuel. And if you start with an inferno, it's very difficult to put that out. Although I haven't seen reports of the Sheffield damage control incident or the action.
Was it a shock to you all there?
I think it was, because we felt ourselves, if you pardon the phrase, to be invincible. We were supremely confident, and because it was so much like an exercise, all we had to do was take pot shots at the ducks going across, and they couldn't fire back, and here was one that fired back. So it brought us to our senses, and perhaps sharpened us up a bit. So from that sense, it was probably very good for us, particularly early on.
Well, did it have any effects on the way, you know, that you operated after that? You were saying about the fire in particular, you know, that's what finished the ship. You would have been equally vulnerable, I imagine, wouldn't you, being the same type of...
Yes, we went through a few phases of soul-searching over various aspects of damage control as to our practice and doctrine before the Falklands and during it. And a number of signals regarding what you should and shouldn't carry and what we should and shouldn't do in terms of procedure came out. But I don't think there was anything we weren't doing or shouldn't have been doing beforehand. It evolved out of that.
Nothing to do with the sort of firefighting equipment. Was there any sort of fault on the Sheffield that you could learn about?
If there was, I can't remember it. As I say, although firefighting is everyone's responsibility, the actual procedure of all the systems of how and where things are tends to be left with the damage control officer.
Right, well, could you go on and tell me, you know, the other engagements that Coventry was involved with? Am I right in thinking the first use of sea dart occurred with Coventry?
Yes, we... I can't remember which day it was, but we were reasonably close to the islands. It might well have been while we were engaged in some gunfire sport, shelling of the airfield. And Puma helicopter was transiting about 10 miles away from us and either hadn't seen us or didn't think we were much of a threat because it wasn't very low. And we picked this up on radar visually and engaged with Sea Dart at about 10 or 12 miles or thereabouts. And it was, as we expect, a perfect shot and knocked it out of the sky in one. I think, if anything, that because I was watching it from the bridge, perhaps was the only thing that really made me sit up and think about the whole business. The fact that there were people in there with families and wives and children. Everything else was very much like an exercise. And I think after that, I think everyone has to get over that at some stage. The fact that you are killing people in one way or another, and once you've got over that, then it then becomes easier, as it were. Not easier to kill them, but easier to reconcile in your own mind that what you're doing is what you should be doing.
Yes, it was interesting when you said earlier that in the Navy you're fortunate that it's not sort of eyeball to eyeball fighting. But I suppose it becomes more abstract, doesn't it, when it's...
Yes, very abstract, and very much like an exercise. And one thing which came out of the whole business, from my point of view, from my perspective, is that it was like an exercise, right up until right at the end. But even then, that then you just switch to your training, and so that bears out the fact that our training was of quality, and that is important. The other engagements we did a sort of watch and watch about on Stanley Airfield. We and Broadsword, on the first day, and then Glasgow and Brilliant on the second day carried out some shelling of Stanley Airfield. We then did it on the third, and Glasgow on the fourth day. And this seemed to be quite a reasonable success. We had the gun, which was very good for NGS, and the Type 22 had the Seawolf, which provided close-in weapons, close-in air defence, and we had the Sea Dart, of course, which gave longer-range air defence. But the 42-22 combo, as it became known, was very much a new tactic. In fact, it was a tactic which was developed over those 4 days. Nobody had ever tried it before. And has since given rise to a tactic which has been trialled and used subsequently and seems to be very useful. It's not something we'd ever put our minds to in the past, because perhaps we had lost a little bit of sight of the inshore battle. Sea Dart is very good, but it is a weapon designed for open ocean, not for one sitting inside or near a landmass, where your radar has great difficulty picking out moving from stationary contacts over a landmass, particularly low level. The radar, which is part of the Seawolf system, is a Doppler radar which does pick out moving targets. It's also a very fast reaction system, which means that if you don't spot something at such a long distance, you still have the ability to engage it. But of course, you can only engage it within a very small area, which is why the two ships had to be very close. So we were normally at about one cable apart for much of the time, which was no problem for ship driving, providing you told each other where you were going, of course. But as it was a new tactic, we were still in the throes of trying to develop it.
Yes, it implies a lot of flexibility in a situation like that, that was developed and extended.
Yes, I think it's a lot for our training that we were able to get two ships driving very close together, often at reasonably high speeds, and carrying out manoeuvres really very safely, and also to fight the ship. It says quite a lot for the flexibility of the training that you could introduce a new tactic and then get on and do it tomorrow or today.
Yes. Mentioning Glasgow, of course, Glasgow was crippled, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes, so this was the first. We and on the first and the third days had no enemy action against us when we were shelling the airfield. On the second and fourth days, Glasgow and Brilliant were there. And on the fourth day, and this is perhaps why we stopped it at that point, Glasgow was attacked by four Skyhawks, I believe, and one bomb went through after engine room or thereabouts and went in one side of the ship and bounced through and came out the other side. The other aircraft were taken out by Brilliant's Seawolf system, which, if nothing else, proved the Type 42-22 combo tactic. But it was still one we had to develop. Of course, Glasgow at that stage was out of combat and had to retire.
Mm-hmm. So that's really two out of the three of your type had gone at this stage then, is that right?
Yes, but by that stage other ships were coming south, and other air defence ships were heading south. Out of the original ships in spring train, yes, of the Type 42 contingent, there was just ourselves left.
So was that a shock for you, another shock?
Not particularly, because we didn't see it. So it was just like another ship leaving an exercise. There was nothing traumatic. For example, if we'd have seen something like the hood blowing up in the chasing of the Bismarck, that would have been fairly traumatic. But we didn't see anything like that. And so it didn't have very much effect at all. It meant shuffling around positions and things. When Sheffield went, Glasgow and ourselves had to take a bigger area of responsibility. But apart from that, I don't think it affected morale a great deal.
It's very interesting, I think, what's coming out of this interview. It's a sort of feeling of relative isolation the ships have from each other. The things go on and you are not aware of it. There's this vast ocean, I suppose, separating.
Yes, you can see the other ships. Quite often you can see the other, you normally see the other ships around you. In fact, we were a little bit cynical on the beginning of the month, because the first time we saw either carrier, either Invincible or Hermes, was not until the 2nd or 3rd of May, because heading south, we had been by ourselves, we'd been ahead of the group, and then putting ourselves up threat, being put up threat, we were too far to see them anyway. And it wasn't until one day we closed in for a replenishment, and the visibility improved, that we actually realised there were other ships there. So you know, we could have been by ourselves, all we knew, if we hadn't looked at the radar, of course. But most of the time, you could see at least four or five other ships around you. And, of course, they were on the radio circuits, and you knew where they were on the screen.
So the role of the Royal Navy in the battle for the Falklands, am I right in thinking that you were there to sort of deal with the threat, the air threat in particular, so that the landings could occur?
In the early stages, it was necessary to acquire sea superiority, and more importantly, perhaps air superiority, which is something we have had to relearn in battles ever since the aeroplane was invented. And that was our first objective. And only by doing that could you then consider to have a chance of the landing. However, the role of the Navy, of course, was much greater than that, because the Navy also supplied the air defence, because they were primarily fleet air arm, and the Navy, of course, supplied the vast amount of the landings, because the Royal Marines were the main landing force.
But had the, before the landings occurred, do you think the, so far as you know, that you are, and perhaps were aware at the time, I know this is difficult putting yourself back there, had you done your job to prepare the way for the landings, do you think? Had the Royal Navy done its job?
Yes. I think we have. I don't think you could look at the landings in isolation. It was all part of one operation. They may have had different names, different aspects of it. But as far as the amphibious operation is concerned, it was very much a naval matter. And we were operating in support of the landings. So I don't think it was a question of our doing our job and then the land forces doing theirs, because the land forces were part of the Navy as well. And in an amphibious operation, and had my last job was the Ops Officer of Intrepid, so I got to see it from the other side. In terms of amphibious operation, it is just a continual conveyor belt from the time people leave their base port until the landings have been achieved. There isn't a sort of cut-off point between the two.
So the actual landings, were you, did you participate, you know, were you, did you have a role in these? San Carlos, Ajax and Pebble Island, I suppose, are they?
We were not involved in those per se. We were involved in an operation off Pebble Island, which was gunfire support, which was just before the Special Forces heliborne attack on the place. And we did some gunfire support there for a couple of days. But that really was to sort of soften it up. But the main landings, our role was to the north of the islands to give air defence cover, or offshore air defence. And that was the role of the ship anyway. We would have been of very limited value if we'd have been inside San Carlos water.
Of course, the Royal Marines played a very big role, didn't they, in the landings. I wonder what the relationship is felt to be between the Marines and the Royal Navy.
Well, the Marines are part of the Navy, and very much an integral part of the Navy. They are very competent, very professional exponents of amphibious warfare. And the Navy provide the dark blue side of amphibious warfare. Amphibious warfare is something which is neither land nor sea, but must be both. And it is a very complex and complicated business. It requires a great deal of early preparation and very meticulous planning, a great deal of logistics in terms of planning, and then requires precision operations in terms of getting people to the right place at the right time in the right order. And I think the fact that the Marines are part of the Navy gives the whole force a cohesiveness, which it wouldn't have had if, for example, we had had the paras doing an amphibious landing. The Marines are well practiced in amphibious landing. They drive the landing craft. They provide a large contingent of the assault ships. And it is their bread and butter, in the same way that it is the Navy's bread and butter in those areas of the Navy that operate in amphibious shipping.
Well, once the landings had occurred, and then it became a sort of land battle as well, I wonder what the perception, your own perception, you know, as a sailor, what you feel about the role of the soldier, whether you feel sympathy for them on land rather than sea, or whether your job is more dangerous. I wonder if, you know, if there is any perception of their role. I know this is interesting in Gallipoli, interviewing the sailors who were there to help the landings at Gallipoli, their view of what the soldiers were doing.
I think you have a certain amount of admiration, and I think on both sides is a sort of question of, I wouldn't be in their shoes. Certainly the number of land forces who came through Coventry for one reason or another were very happy to get away from a ship, which they perceived to be as being a very dangerous object. And on the other hand, if we'd have been ashore, we'd have been like a fish out of water. That's because of our training. We had the advantages, and we carried our home around with us, so we were fairly palatial, whereas the soldier was life was in a dugout or a mud hole. And so there's an element of being used to what you had and not wishing to swap it. So there's a certain amount of sympathy with the other side.
Is really the a point about the landings would be, you know, obviously this must have affected your morale even more when they were accomplished.
Yes, I hadn't any experience of amphibious operations in my naval training up to that stage. and so I wasn't able to follow fully what was going on, all the complexities and the subtleties of amphibious operations. As far as we were concerned, we were there to give air defence cover to it. And we felt that San Carlos was a very dangerous place. But that was seen from the outside. That was our perception of it. We were very confident that the landings would take place and that the Marines would then move inland. But the most vulnerable time is just during the landings. And, of course, we appreciated that. And our role at this stage was about 10 miles north of Pebble Island, in order to give air defence to aircraft coming out of or coming into the sound from the north, or try to take aircraft coming from the south.
I haven't actually asked you, what the area is like, the Falkland Islands. You have explained that the weather was better than perhaps a lot of us think it was, you know, that you had these lovely sunny days. But is it an attractive place to be in? You know, obviously, take away the war situation.
The Falklands are in three parts, from my limited experience of being ashore there. West Falkland is very much like the west coast of Scotland or Cornwall, very rugged place, very sheer cliffs, and a lot of wildlife. I think in a certain ruggedness is very beautiful, very few trees. But apart from that, quite a fascinating place. East Falkland is in two halves. The northern half is slightly more undulating and is the bit that comprises Stanley, so is more built up, although only relatively. The southern part of East Falkland is very, very flat. And in fact, going back later, I noticed that you could hardly see it from about 5 or 6 miles away, because it's very, very low in the water, very flat, and it's really very uninteresting. West Falkland, I think, is very attractive. And San Carlos and Falkland Sound, which runs through the middle, is quite an attractive part in itself. And the number of nooks and crannies, the little inlets and waterways, particularly around West Falkland, make it a fascinating and almost unexplored place, although less so these days.
I think we come now to the 25th of May, don't we?
The 25th of May saw us about 10, 12 miles north of Pebble Island, which is on West Falkland, on the north coast, just slightly to the west of the entrance to Falkland Sound. And we were there with broadsword in our 42-22 combo, steaming up and down to act as air defence picket and air defence units from the north. The advantage of this was twofold. Not only do we have a weapons system, but also we had a long-range radar, and we were able to provide air defence picture to the ships in the sounds. So although we may not necessarily been able to engage targets, we were able to tell people where the targets were. The day started fairly normally, although we were aware that the 25th of May was a national day for Argentina. I think our only thought on this matter was the fact that they may well provide a sort of slightly greater attempt to hit something, although we didn't necessarily see ourselves as being a prime target. But wouldn't it be a good idea if we were able to take out the carrier on the 25th of May? But that was something that appealed to our sense of humour. During the early part of the afternoon, in Greenwich time, which was about 4 hours after sunrise, the first couple of aircraft we saw coming out of the sound after the first attack on the amphibious units, coming out of the sound, and we engaged one, if not both, with Sea Dart. And from what I remember, either one or both were hit. So that was a successful start to the day. And that was with Sea Dart. The contacts were obviously too far away and not coming at us for broadsword Seawolf to be used. Although what we were able to do, I believe, on one of these was to use information from her radar with contacts coming over land using her Doppler radar in order to see where they were and transfer them by computer link to our ship for us to engage them. And that's something you can do between two computer-fitted ships. So although we weren't able to see them on our long-range radar, we were able to pick them up on our fire control radar, having got the target from Broadsword's Doppler radar. So that put us in a fairly buoyant mood. The afternoon was relatively quiet, and about 1600 or thereabouts, another couple of aircraft came out of the sound once again, probably fairly low, at sort of a couple of hundred feet, and we saw them very fleetingly on radar, and we engaged the front one with Sea Dart and took that out. And I believe the second one, although we locked onto, the pilot ejected before we had a chance to fire the missile, because they were only 10 miles away, and that would have taken Sea Dart a very, very short space of time to get there. So quite a prudent pilot had ejected. It must have been a couple of seconds before we actually fired the missile. At this point, I remember the captain talking about whether we should move our position, because it was quite likely that we'd have been seen. There was also one other incident, which I think was that day, when four aircraft coming in from the north were engaged by two Harriers. There's also one other incident, which I believe was that day, when four aircraft coming in from the northwest were engaged by two Harriers. At the time, they seemed to be quite a long way away, but in retrospect, as we could actually see all four aircraft, they must have been fairly close, probably about 5 or 6 miles, which actually was probably a little bit too close for comfort. It was quite an interesting action, because there was a small cloud. I remember this fairly vividly. It was a very, very good visibility and relatively low sea state, and the sky was very bright, and the two Harriers were above this little cloud, and the four Skyhawks, which we presume they were fairly low, obviously making their approach to Falkland Sound. And we had the AWC circuits, that's the anti-air warfare coordination radio circuit, on a loudspeaker on the bridge, and we could hear the aircraft been directed to take out these Skyhawks, and then you switch to the fighter control circuit. And we can see the Harriers coming in with Sidewinders and take out three of the aircraft, and the fourth one then returned in the general direction of his base. So that was fascinating to watch, and that we had a grandstand view of that. The aircraft coming straight at us, and then the two cap aircraft over the top. The discussion with the captain and one of the warfare officers centred on whether we should move our position, whether we'd been spotted, and whether we were likely to be under threat. And I think the general consensus was, yes, we were under threat, but moving position would have had very little effect, because we couldn't move it far enough to be still do our job and yet to provide maximum cover. So we stayed where we were.